that.
Hey,
come
Joe,
on.
Let me just tell you, Joe, I've done more in 47 months. I've done more than you've done in 47 years.
Just have 20 seconds, Kate Aronoff, your final response.
Like most of the 1%, Donald Trump lives by a different set of rules. Most working people pay more taxes than Donald Trump has paid in the last 15 years. The Times reporting is very clear, and we need to get him out of office. That's it. I mean, we need a much better tax code, and we need to tax the rich much more than they are now.
Kate Aronoff of The New Republic, thanks so much for being with us. And if you'd like to see the whole debate, 90 minutes of the free-for-all, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. Stay safe, wear a mask.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Eco Film Festival from September 24th through October 1st, streaming online. The 2020 Portland Eco Film Festival features 30 films, a youth showcase, and interviews with the filmmakers. Again, that's the Portland Eco Film Festival, from September 24th through October 1st, streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Mayor Ted Wheeler's request for the feds to undeputize Portland police officers has been denied. Proud Boys member Alan Sweeney has been arrested on 12 charges, and Maryland becomes the first state to ban foam takeout containers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 30th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. The majority of the Portland Police Bureau's rapid response team was deputized as federal marshals for Saturday's far-right rally. City officials, like Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, were apparently under the impression that local police would keep that designation only temporarily, assuming it ran out when the state of emergency ended on Monday. Mayor Wheeler yesterday requested that the 56 officers be undeputized by the U.S. Marshal's Office. OPB today reported that his request has been denied, meaning those officers will keep their federal designation until the end of the year. A joint statement from Oregon's U.S. Attorney Billy Williams and U.S. Marshal Russ Berger read today, quote, "Importantly, the federal deputation supports frontline law enforcement officers and their families in a way they have not seen from City Hall." In addition to those 56 officers, 22 individuals from the Sheriff's Office have also been federally deputized. After months of pressure, Wheeler finally banned the use of CS gas, one of the many types of munitions used by the Portland Police Bureau and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. Federally deputizing local police means those individuals are no longer bound by that restriction. Importantly, the designation also allows federal prosecutors to bring federal allegations on those arrested, which are likely to have greater consequences than local charges. Proud Boy Alan Sweeney is now in police custody. Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt announced this morning that Swinney is being held for 12 charges related to right-wing rallies in August. He is being charged with 6 misdemeanors and 6 felonies. The charges include multiple counts of assault and attempted assault, unlawful use of a weapon, unlawful use of mace, menacing, and one count of pointing a firearm at another person. His bail is set at just over $500,000. Swinney's alleged crimes occurred at rallies in downtown Portland on August 15th and August 22nd. Video footage from the events shows Swinney making himself visible on the front lines, carrying a paintball gun as well as bear mace, and organizing the shield line with a revolver on his hip. Additional footage from August 22nd shows Swinney pointing his gun into the crowd of counter-protesters with his finger on the trigger. He also faces 2 lawsuits from injuries plaintiffs say he inflicted during the rallies. One Portlander sued him last month, saying he shot her with paintballs in the chest. The Oregon Justice Resource Center also filed a $1.2 million lawsuit against Swinney and 2 other right-wing agitators last week for violence perpetrated at these rallies. Swinney's arrest comes one day after President Donald Trump told the Proud Boys to, quote, stand back and stand by when he was asked to condemn white supremacists during last night's debate. Swinney's arraignment is scheduled for tomorrow, October 1st. In a historic victory, the state of Maryland has become the first state to ban foam food containers. Diane Bernard with the Public News Service has that story.
In a victory for environmental groups, tomorrow Maryland becomes the first state in the nation to ban foam food containers. The new law prevents restaurants, schools, and other places that serve food from using polystyrene or styrofoam cups and containers or face a $250 fine. Kate Breeman with the group Environmental Maryland says the move is a major step forward for a cleaner earth. She points out that polystyrene is difficult to recycle and is one of the most common and hazardous forms of single-use plastic.
The thing about it that's really troubling is that it never goes away. It breaks up into these little teeny polystyrene bits that end up in our water, in our wildlife. And at this point, we're seeing a growing body of research that says even humans are showing this presence of microplastic.
The Maryland Retailers Association, which represents restaurants, is opposed to the ban. In a statement, it says the state should invest in equipment that can recycle polystyrene instead. It also points out that alternative products are more costly, so the law will likely raise prices for diners, which could hurt business during the pandemic. Breeman says Maryland's new law, which was passed in 2019, leads the way for other states to reduce what she calls their over-reliance on single-use plastic. Since the 1970s, she says, more and more plastic has been produced, causing serious environmental consequences when much of it ends up in landfills or waterways.
There was a study that showed in just 1 year, in just America, we threw out 25 billion polystyrene foam cups. Just cups, not clamshells. And you think about the fact that of the polystyrene that even is recyclable, maybe 3% of it gets recycled.
Just last week, the New Jersey legislature passed what some are calling one of the strictest anti-plastic laws in the nation, banning polystyrene products and plastic bags. And in Maine, that state's polystyrene ban goes into effect in January. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
On Wednesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 220 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total number of confirmed and presumptive cases up to 33,509. Oregon health officials also reported 4 new deaths, raising the state's death toll up to 559 people. COVID-19 infections in the state rose by 32% the week of September 21st through September 27th. Nationally, the infection rate rose 13% from the previous 2 weeks' average. More than 7.2 million people in the United States have been infected, and at least 206,000 people have died. The number of cases globally continues to rise at an alarming rate, with more than 200,000 cases reported each day. So far, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 33 million people in nearly every country. And as of Tuesday afternoon, more than 1 million people have died of the virus across the world. Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty endorses Chloe Udaly for a second city commission term. Despite clashes over the police budget this summer, Commissioner Hardesty renewed her primary endorsement of Udaly, saying, quote, Commissioner Udaly and I haven't always agreed on every policy position. However, our values are closely aligned, and we have agreed on much more than we have disagreed on. Udaly's the incumbent. She faces a runoff race in November against community organizer Mingus Mapps, who has received endorsements from the Portland Police Association and former Mayor Sam Adams. Udaly adds Hardesty's endorsement to a list that includes the Sunrise Movement, District Attorney Mike Schmidt, and Portland Tenants United. A 2022 ballot initiative entitled, quote, Protect Free Speech and Safe Streets would put restrictions on the freedom of assembly. It was submitted Monday to the Oregon Secretary of State. Among the chief petitioners are Portland Police Association President Daryl Turner, the Police Association's attorney Anil Correa, and Representative Jeff Barker of Aloha. The initiative will establish broader criteria for a city to institute restrictions on First Amendment-protected gatherings, including a 10 p.m. noise ordinance for assemblies within a quarter mile of residences and midnight anywhere else. Many of the criteria in the initiative are already used by authorities when declaring an unlawful assembly, including blocking streets, use of laser pointers, starting fires and damaging property, and the initiative would add blocking sidewalks to that list. The plan would force officers to display identification when interacting with protesters and would block the requirement of fees and permits for legal demonstrations. The measure would additionally create detailed policies on the types of munitions allowed to be used on protesters and criteria for their use, as well as policy for when a protest can be declared an unlawful assembly or a riot. Activist Leah Thomas is calling on environmentalists to stand in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2014, Leah Thomas was in college studying environmental science and policy when a crisis unfolded in her hometown of Ferguson, Missouri. Police shot unarmed Black teenager Michael Brown, sparking widespread protests.
I'm trying to learn about the Clean Air Act while my sister is getting tear gas back home in a protest.
She says the events made her question who the Clean Air Act really protects. And her concern increased when she read data showing that people of color are more exposed to many air and water pollutants. As a Black woman, she was dismayed.
Because I would say, that's me on that page. That's my community. That's my family.
So this past May, in what became a viral Instagram post, Thomas called on environmentalists to stand in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. And she defined what she calls intersectional environmentalism.
It's a more inclusive version of environmentalism that identifies the ways in which injustices happening to marginalized communities and the earth are interconnected.
She hopes that the definition helps articulate a new approach to environmental activism, one that has the well-being of the planet and people at its core. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Schools and public libraries still censor the books we're allowed to read, and many in recent years include stories about people who identify as LGBTQIA+. Mary Sherman of the Public News Service has more.
Bookworms and literature buffs in Missouri are celebrating freedom of choice of reading materials and denouncing attacks on what they say is their First Amendment right to read. This is Banned Books Week, spotlighting attempts to censor books. More than 600 books, films, and other literary materials were targeted for censorship in 2019, a 14% increase from the previous year. Missouri Delegate for the American Association of School Librarians Matt King says many books challenged in recent years feature content about people who identify as LGBTQIA.
But also, some books are banned for encouraging disruptive behavior like Captain Underpants, or referring to magic and witchcraft like Harry Potter. There's a plethora of books that have been banned for various reasons. Even Dr. Seuss books have been banned.
A bill in this year's Missouri legislature would empower parental library review boards to remove what they deem age-inappropriate sexual material from public libraries. Failure to comply could mean a misdemeanor charge, a fine of up to $500, or up to a year in jail. But no action has been taken on the bill since May. Two-thirds of censorship challenges occur in public libraries, followed by schools. President of the Missouri Association of School Librarians, Kirsten Shaw, says it's important to understand that not every book is the best choice for every student. But for every book, there is a student for whom it is a good choice. She says kids need stories that act as mirrors and windows.
Our kids should see themselves reflected in what they're reading, but then they should also be looking into other perspectives, looking into others' lives as well, to build that empathy.
Shaw contends it should be up to a parent to decide if material is appropriate for their child, not the community. And she notes that kids often self-censor without intervention.
Adults like to step in because we're trying to protect, but sometimes it's a little heavy-handed. So I think we should trust kids to be able to say on their own that this is not for me or I'm not ready for this.
Learn more online at www.ala.org. For Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth segment which features infectious disease experts fact-checking the COVID-19 crisis. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 56 degrees, and tomorrow expect sunny skies with a high of 85. Today in history, in 1928, activist and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel was born. He authored 57 books, including Night, a harrowing account of his experiences at the Auschwitz concentration camp. He consistently and publicly condemned other human rights violations throughout his life. In 2018, anti-Semitic graffiti was found on his childhood home. The quote of the day is from Wiesel, who wrote in his book Night, quote, "We must take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. I swore never to be silent whenever and wherever human beings endure suffering and humiliation. We must always take sides." News poet Dan Raphael is yearning for a yes.
There's no debate with Trump. No issues, no leadership, no responsibility, no morals or compassion, no facts or honesty, no stand down to the Proud Boys, but a stand by. It's lie and deny, accuse and abuse, threaten and encourage others to do so. The dictionary editors need to redefine presidential and find another word for our government than democracy. Trump pays no taxes. Almost no lives matter to him. He doesn't want an election without intimidation, obstruction, and confusion. If he leaves office, he'll need to leave the country to avoid arrest. Nothing to keep COVID from killing its second million. No relief checks in the mail. No end to the fires in the West. No sense in waiting 5 weeks, but no choice. Still, I won't say no hope. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
During last night's debate, presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump debated for an hour and a half on six topics, though there was little actual discussion on those pressing issues. A key topic focused on race and violence in our cities, prompting a false statement from Trump, who claimed the Portland sheriff was in support of him. Multnomah County Sheriff Mike Reese was quick to negate that claim. During the debate, almost immediately after, Trump said that the Portland sheriff, quote, just came out today, and he said, "I support President Trump." Sheriff Reese posted on Twitter a swift rebuke. Reese's post reads, quote, "In tonight's presidential debate, the president said the Portland sheriff supports him. As the Multnomah County sheriff, I have never supported Donald Trump and will never support him." Law and order was a hot topic in last night's debate, with both candidates offering different stances. In response to Trump's false claim that Biden wants to defund police, Biden offered an alternative description of what his four-year presidency would look like for police. He said, quote, "They need more assistance. They need, when they show up for a 911 call, to have someone with them as a psychologist or psychiatrist to keep them from having to use force and be able to talk people down. We have to have community policing like we had before, where officers get to know people in their communities." Prior to the debate, Biden had said he wants to add $300 million in funding to local police budgets. Ironically, the Trump administration has said they would defund the police by cutting about $500 million from overall state and local law enforcement aid. Of additional local interest was Trump refusing to condemn white supremacist groups and telling the Proud Boys to, quote, stand by. Stand by, according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, means to, quote, be or get ready to act. Proud Boy leaders took Trump at his word last night, with many individuals acknowledging they have Trump's blessing and that they will continue to stand by their country. At a press briefing this morning, Trump said he has, quote, no idea who the Proud Boys are, quickly drawing parallels to his 2016 declaration that he, quote, knows nothing about David Duke or white supremacists. The Commission on Presidential Debates announced this morning that, quote, last night's debate made clear that additional structures should be added to the format of the remaining debates to ensure a more orderly discussion of the issues. Changes to the format will include a mute button option for participants' microphones. Here's Lily Bolke of 2020 Talks with some more thoughts on last night's debate.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
No, we're done, sir.
Fox News moderator Chris Wallace tried almost constantly to intervene during last night's first presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden in Cleveland. Before the debate began, right-wing sites like InfoWars and the Trump campaign put out false claims suggesting Biden somehow had an unfair advantage, but the interruptions came mostly from President Trump. Wallace tried to pin Trump down on the New York Times report that he paid just $750 in federal income taxes his first year in office.
I paid millions of dollars in taxes, millions of dollars of income tax.
The just-released Biden records show they paid $288,000 in 2019 federal income taxes. Despite 200,000 coronavirus deaths, Trump falsely stated that most governors, including Democrats, think he did a phenomenal job and that millions more would have died under Biden leadership. Trump also declined to condemn white supremacist violence, telling the Proud Boys, a right-wing militant group, to, quote, stand back and stand by. Trump claims he's only seen violence from the left. The FBI is clear most violence in America has come from right-wing extremists. Saying, quote, violence is never appropriate, Biden rebutted Trump's misstatements about his position on police reform, again stating he believes police need more funding for training.
These cops aren't happy to see what happened to George Floyd. These cops aren't happy to see what happened to Breonna Taylor. Most don't like it, but we have to have a system where people are held accountable.
In response to Trump's personal attacks, Biden brought the conversation back to issues.
This is not about my family or his family. It's about your family, the American people.
Climate advocates successfully got a last-minute question added. Trump admitted that fossil fuel emissions are a problem, quote, to an extent, unquote, but quickly pivoted to incorrectly blame inadequate forest management for wildfires raging in the West. Biden sidestepped Trump's attack on the Green New Deal, emphasizing that his own plan is different.
There's so many things that we can do now to create thousands and thousands of jobs. We can get to net zero in terms of energy production by 2035.
Given another chance to say he'd wait until election results are certified to declare victory, Trump continued attacking the integrity of the election without any credible evidence.
I'm urging my supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully, because that's what has to happen.
Biden simply said, quote, yes, he'd wait, and urged Americans to use whatever method is most comfortable for them.
If we get the votes, it's going to be all over. He's going to go. He can't stay in power. It won't happen. It won't happen. So vote.
One thing the candidates did agree on.
We won't know. We might not know for months.
Some of these ballots in some states can't even be opened until Election Day.
This year will be more of an election season. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
A dying Indigenous woman filmed herself being taunted in a Quebec hospital, leading to an appeal from the First Nations for the government to address a culture of racism in Quebec. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A nurse has been fired and an investigation is being launched after a dying Indigenous woman was taunted in a Quebec hospital. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, before her death, the woman took a video of herself pleading for help.
Joyce Echiquan had gone to the hospital in Joliet, northeast of Montreal, complaining about stomach pains. Before her death, she filmed herself from her hospital bed. The video showed she was in distress and pleading for help. It also showed two female hospital staff coming into her room and making insulting comments. One says she's stupid as hell and that she's only good for sex and better off dead. That video, after going online, sparked widespread anger. It also led to an appeal from Ghislaine Picard of the Assembly of First Nations to call on the Quebec government to address a culture of racism.
In that video, you can clearly hear the nurses insulting Joyce because she is Atikamekw, because she is Indigenous. We recognize the filthy prejudices that continue to exist today.
Picard says a coroner's inquest won't change anything about the racism displayed by the nurses. He says it's a question of attitude and culture, and discrimination in public services is still far too prevalent. The Premier of Quebec offered his condolences to the family and confirmed that a nurse had been fired. He acknowledged that racism exists in Quebec. He added that what happened is unacceptable. He said there would be two inquiries, one from the coroner, another from the Regional Health Authority. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A tribe in southeast Alaska has won permanent protection of a historic site. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, complex negotiations secured 150 acres.
Berg Bay lies on the western shores of Glacier Bay, made famous to the outside world by the writings of 19th century naturalist John Muir. But centuries earlier, it had been a major Tlingit population center. Then huge ice sheets forced its inhabitants to relocate south to what's now modern-day Hoonah.
It has a tremendous cultural significance to the Hoonah Tlingit.
Bob Starbard is tribal administrator of the Hoonah Indian Association. He says much of the site is encompassed on a 150-acre parcel that was an original native allotment belonging to the St. Clair family. And 2 years ago, the family put the acreage up for sale. The asking price, $1.7 million.
We knew that there were some development interests on the part of the lodge owners interested in developing, and that was a use that we felt was incompatible.
But financing such a large deal proved difficult. The National Park Service was also interested, but the federal agency found that the asking price exceeded what the government considered fair market value. That's when the Conservation Fund got involved. It's a Virginia-based nonprofit that buys land and deeds it over to agencies for conservation. Brad Micheljohn is the fund's Anchorage-based Alaska representative.
We heard clearly from the park that they wanted to find a creative way to make this happen because of the history of the use of the park by the folks from Hoonah.
The fund partnered with the National Park Foundation, another nonprofit with a similar mission, to buy the property outright for an undisclosed sum. It's since deeded the 150 acres to the federal government to be added to Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve.
The tribe will get special access.
Philip Hoogie is the National Park Superintendent. He authorized inking a formal agreement codifying special rights for the tribe.
And it's been a long road to return that sense of homeland and to have, you know, the Park Service recognize that.
Formal plans will be worked out between the tribe and Park Service each spring. The grassy valley and 2,200 feet of beach along Berg Bay will be for both tribal members and park visitors to enjoy. I'm Jacob Resnick.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The government of India has frozen Amnesty International's bank accounts there, so the organization has laid off staff and shut down operation in the country. Julie Verhaar is the acting Secretary General of Amnesty International. She said, quote, "This is an egregious and shameful act by the Indian government, which forces us to cease the crucial human rights work of Amnesty International India for now." The government said the group had broken the law by circumventing rules around foreign donations, which Amnesty denies. The organization has been critical of the Indian government in recent years, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi's revocation of the special status of Jammu and Kashmir last year and human rights abuses in various parts of the country. Avinash Kumar is the executive director of Amnesty International India. They said, quote, "Treating human rights organizations like criminal enterprises and dissenting individuals as criminals without any credible evidence is a deliberate attempt by the Enforcement Directorate and Government of India to stoke a climate of fear and dismantle the critical voices in India." You are listening to a Fall Membership Drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's broadcast includes Hendrik Brokelschen, Samantha Law, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Diane Bernard, Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Anthony Lizowitz, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We'll be featuring infectious disease experts fact-checking the COVID-19 pandemic. Stick with us.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started. Racism in COVID-19 versus America. CNN reporter Don Lemon remarked earlier in the pandemic that there are two deadly viruses killing Americans, COVID-19 and racism.
So, that's evident in a lot of ways. Black people have died from COVID-19 at faster rates than white people. And now we're seeing stunning economic damage that COVID-19 has caused amongst Black Americans, Native Americans, and Latinx.
There's a vicious cycle spinning here. The CDC says discrimination, healthcare access, and gaps in income, wealth, and education are all leading factors that put minorities at increased risk. We have a new survey by NPR, public health researchers at Harvard, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It found that about 4 in 10 people of color have had to spend the majority of their savings during the crisis.
Ay, ay, ay.
Some 72% of Latinx community reported serious financial problems. Roughly 60% of Black households and 50% of Native American households can say the same. Millions have lost wages, been furloughed, or fired from their jobs during this time.
So let's make this very clear. Bills aren't being paid. Food is not getting to families. Internet access now has also become an issue. All of that impacts children or communities of color in particular, and there's an effect to get more digital gear to kids, but we're still seeing issues with families who simply cannot afford that internet bill each month.
Police brutality and racial inequities are critical issues for our communities of color. But the pandemic, too, is already putting new pressures on Black and brown families nationwide.
You know, one thing that we've seen and that we've said many times here, Dr. Griggs, on Noise Filter, is how the virus has kind of removed the bandage on gaping wounds of inequalities, especially when it comes to social inequities and healthcare inequities with COVID-19. And just this is just another one. And we were just talking about this on our daily Facebook show about how internet access is now becoming such an important point with respect to children and being able to educate.
This has been a problem before the COVID pandemic and will remain a problem unless we address it while it's on the table.
Absolutely.
Increase in stillbirths globally in COVID-19. Some recent studies suggest that stillbirths have risen during the pandemic. That doesn't appear to be a complication due to COVID-19, though.
No, it looks more to be a consequence of poor access to healthcare during the crisis. Doctors advising their pregnant patients to not come in for visits to cut down potentially on exposure risk. So there's been a decline in prenatal care due to the pandemic, but we know that prenatal care is so important for healthy babies and for moms as well.
Yeah, what we're seeing now is what happens when there's not enough prenatal care. One study collected data from 9 hospitals in Nepal. The data showed a dramatic increase in stillbirths in the early months of the pandemic. 14 births in 1,000 were stillbirths back in March. This stat jumped about 50% by the end of May.
So similar trends are being reported in London as well. Data there indicated a huge jump in stillbirths between late last year and this summer. And it looks like this may be a case where telemedicine can be lacking, because online visits have replaced many in-person consultations after all. Certainly it has in my personal practice where I do HIV and Hep C work. But it also makes it more difficult for doctors and nurses to adequately monitor expectant mothers for their vital signs, and that could be potentially a predictor for what the outcome of a birth would be.
Yeah, infant and maternal mortality are critical issues in low and middle income countries. It's definitely an area that needs a lot further research, and really, Doc, quite frankly, needs a lot more attention.
It really does. And also, let me just add too that a lot of society's inequities can be measured by infant mortality and maternal mortalities look like. So we really do need to focus more on that. And here in the U.S., our infant mortality rates are horrific, and we need to spend a lot more time on being able to increase access and decreasing inequities to allow for more individuals to access healthcare as much as possible. The psychology of mask wearing. So let's move past the messaging and let's get to the meat of it all. How often do you go out in public and you see someone not wearing a mask? What do? Do you feel like asking them to put one on? I personally don't. I've moved way, way beyond that.
Yeah, we're past that point. Thankfully for your safety.
Yes, thankfully. Did you hear about these people that ran through like Target or something saying we're not going to take it? Like, the song by Dee Snider. Dee Snider had to respond to it. He tweeted.
Oh,
he was like, these guys are a bunch of fools.
Yeah.
Like, don't use my song. I didn't give you permission. And wear a mask.
You know, we tend to see this a lot as quarantine fatigue sets in, which we absolutely do understand.
Yes.
But we're also seeing people, and we're seeing people expand their pool of frequent contacts beyond their own households. They're expanding their pods,
yeah.
So it's no longer really a pod.
Right.
There's a big element of peer pressure at play here, folks. A lot more people seem to be asking, don't you trust us?
Yeah, and this is developing psychology of mask wearing. As humans, we want to be liked and we want to be accepted and we don't want to be shunned or rejected. So some of us may start avoiding masking around close friends or family, but that runs afoul of others who take their safety measures very seriously, myself included.
Yeah, we do see geographic variations. In some places, masking is the status quo. In others, elsewhere, well, it's stigmatized.
Yes, I wonder where.
Masking culture is a
time... Not far from where we live.
I gotta finish.
Okay.
Masking culture is time-tested in many countries. Here in the U.S., it's becoming very much the new normal, and for some, and not normal at all for others.
Yeah, absolutely. But remember this, research does tell us that the more people see others wearing masks, the more likely that they're going to wear masks themselves. And it's really okay to jump on the bandwagon, folks. Mask up.
COVID down.
Addressing burnout amongst the nation's frontline healthcare professionals. Doc Griggs, I added this one here. I put this story in our pitch meeting just so that you and I can talk about it.
Yeah, you struck a nerve.
Because working as a healthcare provider, it can be rewarding, and yes, it can. It can be exciting, and society really does offer a lot of perks for healthcare providers, and we do appreciate that very much. But it can also be very, very stressful.
Yeah, Doc, you think? Burnout was a common issue amongst healthcare workers even before the pandemic, and a recent study by Medscape showed that about 62% of nurses and 42% of doctors reported feeling exhausted in the fight against the coronavirus.
Yes.
But many of the doctors and nurses won't get help. While one reason is because they're worried about stigma and judgment, but more importantly, Doc, it's because we are...
healthcare heroes?
That's one way to put it. We're working. We're busy.
Yes.
Doc, we've been, literally, I did the math, we have been doing, since mid-March, you and I have been doing about between 16 to 18 hours a day.
Yeah.
7 days a week. Every day is Tuesday.
Every day is Tuesday.
Yeah.
So let's point to a colleague of ours, and it's a really painful case in point. And so I'm going to just talk about it just briefly, but I want to remember and honor Dr. Lorna Breen. She was an emergency medicine physician in New York City during the peak of the pandemic.
Hero.
Yes, talk about healthcare heroes. After dealing with her own personal COVID-19 infection, her work pressures became unbearable that she very, very, very unfortunately and tragically took her her life in April.
Yeah, folks, listen, on a very serious note, you've been listening to us do this podcast long enough. You know who we are. And by now it's clear. You realize we Doc and I, we're not supermen. Our colleagues, our doctors, nurses, other healthcare professionals, the support staff, the other essential workers, everyone that helps make the hospital run, the cafeteria workers, the custodians, the respiratory therapists, physical therapists,
parking,
you name
attendants,
them, parking attendants,
security,
everyone that have allowed us to be able to be here and to try to do our best, as best we could, on the front line, our regular people, when we all have, we have wants, needs, we're afraid like everyone else, but it's our mission to make sure that we take the best care of our community as possible.
And we're doing what we can to take care of ourselves. None of us should hide our feelings or suffer in silence, but that's the sort of thing that really can lead to emotional exhaustion. And burnout doesn't just affect the provider. It can impact patient care as well. So we really need to be aware of that. Doc?
Yeah. It's actually, this, folks, this is such a risk that the National Academy of Medicine is calling on Congress to approve funding to support frontline healthcare providers in their long-term needs. And beyond that, folks, remember, we are all part of the same community battling the same agent, enemy, pathogen, whatever you want to call it. We're battling COVID-19 on all fronts, and we need you like you need us.
Doc Riggs, what are you doing to every day to keep your mental health sanity?
I'm listening to the Hamilton soundtrack and trying to memorize the songs.
There you go. That's excellent. For me, it's a daily run, every day, committed. I will say this. The one thing that COVID-19 has done for me is that I am now committed to every morning being on my terms. No meetings. You know, I'm working,
yeah,
but I'm working on my terms so that the mornings are just very protected, and that's where I do my daily walk or run or meditation.
Yeah, so I need your help to get back there. ICE detention centers accused of substandard COVID-19 treatment and unnecessary hysterectomies. Yeah, there's been a long history of substandard health and safety conditions and human rights violations in immigration detention facilities.
And it continues during the pandemic, unfortunately. But there is a nurse named Dawn Wooten that you may have heard about. And if you haven't, please, please, she's an American hero and she's a whistleblower. And because she's a whistleblower, that makes her an American hero. She worked at Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia. It's a privately run holding center for ICE prisoners. That by itself just, Anyway, Wooten says detainees are not getting COVID tests. Let me say that again. Wooten says that detainees are not getting COVID tests and other needed care. The facility wasn't reporting all of its cases. And workers would even shred medical request forms or, Doc, they fabricated records.
You can't be serious.
Yes.
Wow. Issues like this are popping up at detention centers all across the country. Some report that inmates that are showing symptoms of fever and cough often sleep in the same cells as those who are not. Some of the same sick inmates have received no more care than an hour-long quarantine and some painkillers.
Jesus. An hour-long quarantine. Oh, my goodness. All right. One of the most damning things that Nurse Wooten alleges, and so please, this is the one that really gets to me, and it's so hard for me to even say the words I'm about to say. So Nurse Wooten essentially said, and her whistleblowing complaint was this, was that immigrant women are receiving unnecessary hysterectomies.
Man.
And something that that this country has a deep, dark history of all the deep, dark histories of things that we've done. One of them was sterilizing, in this case here, sterilizing immigrant women, but we have a history of sterilizing Native Americans as well. So particularly, there was one case in which a woman of childbearing age was told that she needed to have her uterus removed because of cysts on her ovaries, a completely different organ.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, and there was another one that was told that she had stage 4 cancer and ended up getting a hysterectomy, only to be later told by another doctor that she never had cancer.
Mm.
Doc, did you hear that?
Yeah.
This doctor, ironically, is still continuing to treat patients despite numerous complaints and lawsuits.
And it's not clear exactly how many hysterectomies this doctor has performed. I would imagine many. And I would imagine many of them were not consented as well. ICE officials are not commenting on the latest allegations. I'm shocked. And they insist that the female detainees are getting the appropriate gynecological care. But that's not going to be enough for federal authorities, thankfully. Doc?
Yeah, you know, this is actually such an issue that the Department of Homeland Security is investigating. And even House Speaker Nancy Pelosi wants to get to the bottom of whatever is going on in South Georgia.
As well she should.
Yeah, we'll keep our eye on this one.
Yes, we will.
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at Noise Filter on Instagram, Noise Filter NOLA on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to NoiseFilterShow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.